Our next speaker is Jerry Zasloff. He's a founding faculty member of Simon Fraser University. He taught European literature, humanities, and the social history of art at SFU since it opened in 1965. He has also been a chair of the SFU English Department and the founding director of the Institute for the Humanities, developing the Humanities Department and the Prague Field School. Currently, Jerry's the co-editor of West Coast Line, a West Coast of Canada Journal of Arts, Letters, and Cultural Criticism, The View from Here. He teaches and publishes happily on utopian controversies, the city in history, photography, cultural memory, art movements in relation to revolution, and cross-cultural understanding, or understanding what is outside of us. Jerry.
Well, thank you. I don't know how happily I do all that. I want to pick up on some of the points that Mort has made, and somewhat anecdotally, but actually analytically, to apply them to my own experience here since 1965. Mort said, consolidated the culture of political reaction, which is, I think, a very focused and trenchant way to put what I think of as the whitewashing of the 1960s by the university administration and the faculty since that time. I've never been at any institution where history is so suspicious, and where memory is even more suspicious in terms of what happened at this institution, not just in the 60s, but in terms of collective memory, in terms of how institutions have seen their rightful organizations to take power and use their power, which is considerable. And in the process, thinking about what happened with the Goldcorp situation and the passivity of faculty in relationship to that, to look back over my own, how much time do I have?
20 minutes.
20 minutes. To look back over the my own past here, and at the risk of being anecdotal, I thought I would like to kind of mention a few things that have happened since that time when I came in 1965. I had been, as a kind of anarchist Marxist, if that's not a contradiction in terms. Depends who you talk to. Who could have gone to UBC in 1965, but I didn't have a tweed jacket, although I did smoke a pipe. And I decided I would be out of my mind not to come to a new university. Who would not want to come to a new university? And moreover, as I'll say in a minute, the anti-nuclear, the liberatory, the emancipatory ethos of that period was so strong that you had hope that a new university would actually make a difference. But more specifically, in terms of the demography in 1965, I came into an English department, small department. The university at that time was only 3,500 students. It's hard to imagine. There was a fair amount of consultation in curriculum building, and I'll go back to that that point. But what was very, very important for me, and I know for some of my colleagues, was the anti-school movement, anti-schooling movement at the time. This magazine is about schools. The Paul Goodman movements, just the general restlessness about the discipline that students had to go through, which fed into the Templeton High School strike, by the way, which was, as Mort pointed out, was one of the very first public sphere activities that turned the public against Simon Fraser. I happened to be appointed, and I can't even remember how I got appointed, to an ethics committee, and Tom Bottomore was on it, to listen to the evidence that was brought by the university powers, MacTaggert Cowan and his crew, to dismiss those PSA graduate students who were simply passing out leaflets and supporting high school students' right to protest. So right from the beginning, there was a sense that we were involved with a dissenting academy. I wrote about this, and if somebody wants to contact me on email, I wrote a long piece back in the 90s about the university as a dissenting social movement, not just students or faculty, but about the university itself. I've also written something, and I can give you the reference to that, about utopian pedagogy. For me at that time, the most exciting aspect of the place was the classroom. We had students who were, I think you mentioned it, Mort, who were first time university goers. The parents were not typically the ones who went to UBC. And this was, without going into the details, this was an extraordinary time to be in a classroom, small classrooms. You won't believe that, for example, one of the most radical things that we did at the time was when the tutorials went from 9 to about 12, we had a protest in English. that we didn't, what kind of teaching is this if you go from
9 to 12?
Yeah, from 9 to 12. And of course you see what happens in the escalating nature of how governance becomes driven by the financial aspect of it and the external, what I call the control, the controlling the externality and those internalities that threaten to spin off the means of controlling the surplus of academic work. That's a fancy analytic way of saying that the university struggled with restructuring from the very time it started in 1965. Restructuring is the mantra that allows the university to take charge of departments, of faculty, and so forth and so on. I was on one of those dismissal tribunals, the Nathan Popkin Tribunal. I was asked by one of the PSA members, Nathan Popkin, to serve on the tribunal. And Mort is absolutely right. All the tribunals that were set up were quasi-judicial at the time and gave determinations. There was a court reporter. These documents sit in the UBC library now, and they need to be researched. A proper history of those days has not been written. There was the book, The Radical Campus, that came out, and Mort didn't like my review of it, I know, which is fair enough, but I wrote a review for CAUT about what I call the myth of radicality at Simon Fraser, which is really the gist of my thematic now that I want to talk about. So along with the anti-nuclear, the various liberatory, there was the East of Main Street students who were coming to Simon Fraser, which was an extremely important place for students to be at that time. Now, what I would like to say too about that period that I learned about on that tribunal, aside from the fact that we determined that there was no cause for dismissal, and our tribunal gave a kind of paradigmatic reading, which you can read about in the CAUT, you can Google all that stuff and get it, that became the kind of one of the landmark academic freedom interpretations at the time. What it revealed to me sitting on that tribunal was the absolute incompetence of the university, and I think it continues. One should never idealize administrators and never assume that they're competent.
No danger in this room, I don't think.
Well, okay, but, but it's an academic disease when you sit down below in a bureaucratic administrative empire to assume that those up above know what they're doing and to assume that they've done their homework and that they've done their research. And if you go back, and the one good thing about Hugh Johnston's book, Radical Campus, is that he looked at the 1963 to 1965 period when the university was set up, and it was real, the Schrum period, and you marvel at the absolute jerry-built, I use that term, I don't mind it, jerry-built way in which it was constructed. And for example, what Mort referred to, there was no academic and freedom or tenure guidelines or brief at the time. They set it up, and it was a kind of makeshift affair, which we discovered in our deliberations. Now, what that means is a very important issue in terms of the future of this institution. For one thing, it means that it was a confusion at the time about the process that Mort talked about in terms of the democratic processes in the department itself, that the confusion of academic and freedom and promotion processes as an administrative and bureaucratic affair with academic freedom as such, associated with research, teaching styles, and how people negotiate social contracts with their students. And that was an extremely important historical moment in that period, which is still being fought everywhere in the United States, in Europe, in Italy, everywhere. And that is the struggle over the processes which enable universities to pay people less, to get rid of people if they decide they want to get rid of people, in order to certify faculty unions or student unions. The university and the Universities Act has that power. But within that, there is my friends in the PSA department were struggling about with, because many of them hadn't completed their degrees, and in the process of all this student movement and struggles, had to produce the kinds of things that professors are supposed to do, right? That I call cultural capital, okay? So this was an extremely important moment where the confusion over what people do, think, teach, and how they express themselves in the classroom. I remember one situation during that time. I think I invited Mort to one of my lectures in the theater, and maybe if it wasn't you, Mort, it was somebody else in the department, to talk about the strike. And I looked at the back, and there was a campus policeman, a cop in the back, right, standing there taking notes. I stopped the lecture. I went back, and I said, "Please leave. This is a sanctum. You don't have to be here. If you want to know what's going on, ask me, and I'll tell you. I have an objective view, right? I'm a scientist." after that was over, I went to see George Stewart and the academic vice president. You know, forgive the anecdotes, but these are instrumental in terms of my own life, you know. Then I went to see George Stewart, the administrative vice president, who was behind the scenes instrumental in terms of the academic governance. He wasn't supposed to be making academic decisions, but he was, which we found out in our tribunal. And I said, "George," you know, his kid went with my kid, played soccer. I said, "George, look, keep your policeman out of my classroom." And he said, "Okay." You know, and I went out of there and I thought, wow, you know, what have I done? A very minor victory. Okay, but what I'm trying to say is those people were as confused about what to do in terms of governance, administration, propriety, and so forth. Now, let me just go, about 10 more minutes?
Yes.
Okay, let me just hit some myths that I would like to talk about. Today, the colliding realities are globalization and making programs for students that the students feel that they can use. And I also think now, if I analyze this, and I'd like to, most universities, in my experience, even though I've been here since 2000 because of mandatory retirement, do not understand the students today. I don't think they have a clue what students are going through, what you've pointed out. And what is important for them is to mobilize the instrumental power of the university to give students programs, give business programs, give kinds of programs that will mirror what the students believe they need and in a certain sense do need, you know. So innovation of curriculum was one of the myths at the beginning of when we started. But it was a myth because it was the PSA department was one of the truly interdisciplinary faculties at the time, or departments at the time. There were a few others, the Faculty of Education, which got hit later on in that period, which was a truly radical, revolutionary curriculum in terms of training teachers. But it was a myth in this regard that it was no more innovative than what was going on in the United States or England at the time, or other universities in Canada. It was a myth in relationship to the hierarchical conservative UBC campus. So that was one of the myths that today, they recycle and restructure the university with all of its downloading onto departments in order to make everything more interdisciplinary. But what is that supposed to mean, right? What is it supposed to mean? You colonize out in the Surrey area, it's interdisciplinary. You go downtown, it's interdisciplinary. And it becomes a mantra. Okay. I mentioned briefly that there was no really consensus about democratic governance, but the consequence of that was that faculty met in one large combined joint faculty, and it was a real serious discussions about academic governance and so forth and so on. In those meetings, we overturned the head system that was inherited from the Canadian UBC tip type system. My point here is that people from sciences and other faculties were talking to each other, fighting to the bitter end, but nevertheless were part of a public academic sphere. This does not exist anymore. This left in the middle 70s because of this restructuring of faculties. Interdisciplinary restructuring is an excuse to take power away from departments. Now, that may be a good thing or a bad thing, but that is one of the consequences of it. Top-down planning. Okay? The community outreach programs, this becomes another mantra throughout the 1970s and the 1980s, to have the university situate itself in the community. One could talk more about that, but that, again, is the $10 million gift by Goldcorp. $5 million of that is to go out, is to do something in the community. But what does that mean? I've worked in the community since the 1970s. We had a prison education program, which the university eventually dismantled and threw out. We had another strong program was the humanities, which we were working in the Carnegie Center for many, many years with prisoners and recidivism and so forth and so on. We introduced the Woodsworth Chair, which was endowed by many small donors from the prairies, by labor lawyers, not by a corporation. Any money that came to our endowment, the Woodsworth or the Humanities Institute, was, I hate to use the word, was ethical money, right? That is to say, there are donors in the Lower Mainland, and I can name them, who, you know, and Van City is involved with a lot of those people, who do not accept gifts from corporations whose history, specific activities are not only suspicious, but are barbaric, right? So this is part of the public sphere that has been lost, right? So the disgusting acceptance of money, and even though, okay, you have money, I'll take it, the university goes cap in hand, bends over, and says, kiss my ass, and I'll kiss yours. Okay, now that's crude, but money is crude, right? So I'm sorry to be coarse about it. Okay, the point that I'm making here is that they've been involved in downtown programs. We have been involved for years and years. Now, recently, for example, they'll accept money for a downtown program, not knowing exactly what it is, but at the same time, the university cancels the seniors program of no tuition for seniors over 55. And I can guarantee you that the money that they saved there was a pittance in regard to the kinds of goodwill, the kinds of education, the kind of public sphere education, which, by the way, goes back to the legacy of the 1960s, that you want to have a university that is open to, as an institution, to different kinds of students, different kinds of people at various stages of life. Okay, now the other institutional point that I could mention, many, many other ones, was the David Noble affair that some of you may know, that I was a co-chair of the J.S. Woodsworth Chair, and watched the university commit suicide over that by the interference with academic process that over the appointment of David Noble to that J.S. Woodsworth chair. Now, there's all sorts of complications over that, whether or not he was the first choice or the second choice, but it was a test case about funding. I sat at a department meeting where the Dean of Arts came in and he said, we've had all kinds of calls about David Noble, right? This was in the humanities department a few months before I retired. A few months before, David Noble had come down to my office in the office of Steve Dew and said, this is a great choice. It's a great choice. He went through all the interview processes and so forth. A few months later, he was not such a great choice. Why? The dean came to our... I'm talking to you about the powerful effect of money in terms of making academic decisions and departmental governance decisions. And he said, we've had 24 phone calls from people who are against David Noble. And I said, well, that's interesting. Who are these people? This is there's due process, thinking back to the 1960s and many other decisions that I have been involved with in my survival here. And, one is always, as a radical in one way or another, by definition, you have one foot in and one foot out. And you have to know how to help people, one foot in and one foot out. And he said, I can't tell you. I said, oh, that's interesting. It's an academic process. Can you black out the names, change the names, and tell us what they said? He said, I can't do that. Okay? Now, The fallout from that was a university a hearing that cost the taxpayers an incredible amount of money, which is still secret, right, as to how much the cost was in terms of the suit that David Noble brought against the university. And in that suit, the university had to eat crow about that. So the point I'm trying to make here is that there's a continuing conflict between democratic governance and classic academic freedom issues. The faculty has been cowed by this. I have never in my whole 40 plus years here seen a faculty. I walk around here, and again, this is anecdotal, and maybe they think they're talking to me because I'm a person they want to, who might listen to them and shake their head and say, it's really terrible. It's an enervating, disillusioning, demoralizing experience to be a faculty member here now. The decision over the Gold Corp was made without, as far as I can understand, Nicholas, because China, about the Board of Governors and paper trail, without the knowledge of the faculty members in that department. And I know those people. I was asked to become the director of that Center for the Arts in 1975 because it was an interdisciplinary, and I refused. For personal reasons rather than... In other words, these are people that I've known. In the 1980s, that department was cut back brutally. And what was cut back in the 1980s was their community outreach, their theater in the streets, and their theater and their music and their dance. It had some relationship to the community. So they couldn't perform those because they didn't have a budget. Okay, so now, how many years later? Another minute?
Okay.
Okay, it feels like I've talked for 10 minutes. But okay, so my point is that it's a money-driven politics, that the lessons and myths of Simon Fraser are there to be learned, but one can't talk about the past, one has to talk about the now. The other event that I'd just like to highlight was the mural, or the Charles Comfort mural, and we had a teach-in that the Cedar Table people organized. And there was a whole day teach-in, which was extremely fine, both at an academic level, an activist level, and an interventionist level. The Charles Comfort mural, which is sitting over there in the quad beneath above the reed sculpture. And we spent a good old-fashioned two-day teach-in over the anthropological significance, the political significance of installing a Toronto Dominion salvage operation without due consultation with either the First Nations people or the anthropologists or the museum people, et cetera. Stevenson, the president, actually used that example, and I'll stop here, mm-hmm. in terms of how protest and dissent is whitewashed, assimilated into the corporate structure, and is used against the dissenting academy because the institution really wants to see itself the good guys in the face of the public, and that's what they have to do, and that's their logic. President we published that in West Coast Line. President Stevenson went to the BC Civil Liberties Union over at UBC, and one of my spies, a wonderful left-wing engineer, went to that, Norman, you know, Norman, and reported back to us. Not a spy, he's a good friend, right? And he said, you know what Stevenson said? He said, well, it's corporate academic freedom.
Because they have so little freedom.
Yeah. Now, you know, but you see, this ties into my main point that the originally in 1965 to 71, 72, it was a conflict between the institution trying to define for itself what is corporate freedom and what are corporate processes and how they can control those versus the, let's say, the traditional and non-traditional forms of dissent and how those are protected at the grassroots level by at the department level. Okay, and the kinds of processes that Moore talked about. Now it's don't rock the boat, really. And it not only makes me sick and unhappy, it brings me back to what I would call the Faustian bargain. You know, I am, after all, a literary person. The Faustian bargain that allows the most highly privileged members of our society, and that's the academic elites, the academics. And nobody is more privileged than the professoriate in the society, and allows them to watch and spectate and turn their back on some egregious examples of incorporating education into the corporate model. Right? How do you protest against that? I'm not sure.
Maybe Kaylee can take that on.
Yeah. Okay.